Today's broadcast was originally recorded on August 20th, 2025.
Like people don't remember. Nobody ever heard of it until I came along. Nobody remembered it for a long time, or they didn't use it. At least I use it all the time. Abraham Lincoln was a Republican.
What?
You know, you say that. People say, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
But he was a Republican.
Oh, good God. And that guy wants to rewrite the Smithsonian.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yeah, it should go well.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I want to get to my guest very quickly today, an historian on Donald Trump's unprecedented attempted takeover and/or whitewashing, pun intended, of the nation's great Smithsonian Institution today, and his attempt to literally rewrite history in his authoritarian image. Want to have plenty of time to speak with this historian and to end today with a song, if time allows, Desi Doyen.
Oh, I hope so.
I hope so, too. I could use one. But quickly, since we have been covering this story very closely for many weeks now, as we go to air, the Republican-led Texas state legislature looks set to advance a new congressional map for the state, crafted to hand five additional U.S. House seats to the GOP in next year's midterm elections at the demand of Donald Trump, who knows his party is likely to otherwise see huge losses next year in the midterms, given the unpopularity of his and the Republicans' policies. Wednesday's adoption of the map by Texas Republicans would come despite fierce opposition from state Democrats who left the state for 2 weeks in order to prevent a quorum that could vote on the new map in the state legislature, which the Democrats say is meant to rig next year's elections. And they, of course, are right. So, adoption of that new map could come at any moment now, after which Democrats vow to challenge it in court. Democrats returned to Texas on Monday after California Governor Gavin Newsom introduced a measure intended to go before California voters this November, to allow the Democratic state legislature here to redraw California's U.S. House districts in favor of Democrats if and only if Republicans are successful in doing so in favor of Republicans in Texas or in other GOP-controlled states who are now considering doing the very same thing that Texas is doing. Currently, California's congressional districts are drawn up by mandate of the state constitution by an independent redistricting commission, which is why we will have to vote on this measure in November. But when those Texas Democrats returned to their state house on Monday, they were ordered by the Republican caucus chair to sign a permission slip that would allow them to be trailed 24/7 by state troopers to make sure that they did not skip town again and that they showed up for Wednesday's vote on the new maps. Now, Democratic State Rep. Nicole Collier refused to sign the document. She was not allowed, somehow this is legal, not allowed to leave the floor. She was locked into the House chamber. She spent the Monday night there, sleeping at her desk under bright lights because she wouldn't sign this permission slip before she was then joined on Tuesday by other Democrats who showed up and tore up their permission slips, said they made a mistake in having signed them in the first place, and they spent Tuesday night sleeping at the Texas legislature as well, along with Rep. Collier. Rep. Penny Morales-Shaw, a Houston area Democrat, told NBC News that she decided to return to stand with Collier because she didn't want to be seen as, quote, validating the GOP's narrative that we were derelict. Nicole was right, she said. We should not have submitted to this. Adding, I cannot support this very low and bad precedent for all future legislators. So, yeah, one person can and does make a difference when they stand up to bullying and authoritarianism.
Turns out courage is contagious.
Even in Texas, if you can imagine. Collier, frankly, should be a lesson for all of us right now, which is why I focused on this story a bit on yesterday's show. Democratic Rep. Rita Andrews-Bowers told reporters that she also believes the decision to have law enforcement follow Democrats was a waste of taxpayer dollars, evoking last month's floods in the Hill Country in Texas that killed more than 135 people. She said, quote, families in the Hill Country who lost everything to the devastating floods need our help. Yet instead of providing relief, those dollars are being spent on constant Department of Public Safety patrol of Democrats. And in fact, Republicans are not even voting on relief funding for the horrific floods in Hill Country in July until after they pass this map.
Texas Republicans are holding flood relief hostage,
yep,
holding those victims hostage so, yep, they can take this extreme power grab.
Yep. So, as noted, the Dems returned to Texas for a number of reasons, but among them was the fact that other states controlled by Democrats had vowed to take action to counter what is happening in Texas. California has already begun that process, but we're still waiting to hear from other Democratic states on what they plan to do, if anything, given that many are limited in their ability to legally redraw U.S. House maps in the middle of the decade. One of those states where the governor has vowed to respond to Texas is the great state of Illinois, led by Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. I hope to have Illinois native Driftglass, our friend, on tomorrow's show, along with our L.A. friend, Digby, to discuss how and if that process is moving ahead right now in the land of Lincoln. And, you know, until I started mentioning it, not many people knew that Illinois was the land of Lincoln until I started talking about it. Anyway, on the other side of the coin, additional Republican states now have also been badgered by the Trump administration to do what Texas is doing, to steal even more seats from Democrats in their states in next year's midterms, including in Ohio, Florida, South Carolina, and Indiana. So how is that going? Well, as TPM reports today, a handful of Republican state lawmakers in Indiana have come out against the Trump administration's redistricting pressure campaign in a state where 7 of Indiana's 9 U.S. House seats are already held by Republicans. Following a White House meeting with Indiana Governor Mike Braun, he and other members of the state legislature's Republican leadership were tight-lipped about whether they would agree to redraw their state's map and potentially flip the only 2 seats the Democrats hold in the U.S. House. But since then, some state lawmakers have come out openly against the scheme. Republican State Senator Jim Lucas said, according to The Hill, quote, for Hoosiers, Indiana Republicans, to abandon their principles and basically take away the rules that set such a dangerous precedent moving forward and for our children. Well, good for him. And if it's, you know, for our children, of course, Republicans would never do anything against the children, right? Well, let's hope so. I'm not counting any chickens yet. But another Republican state House member, Rep. Danny Lopez, posted similar remarks, shooting down the effort on Twitter earlier in the earlier this month. A handful of others have made their opposition clear as well in Indiana, as the Indiana Capital Chronicle and others have reported. And for that, Trump allies are now threatening to primary those Republicans.
Wow.
On Monday, Trump ally, CEO of Turning Point USA and MAGA influencer Charlie Kirk posted on Twitter that his group would, quote, support primary opponents for Republicans in the Indiana state legislature who refuse to support the team and redraw the maps. It's time for Republicans to be tough, said Kirk. Tough by, you know, screwing over voters in their own state. As Republicans in Indiana met as a caucus to discuss Trump's redistricting squeeze, Politico reports on a new pressure campaign underway in the state, reportedly linked to Trump's political operation. That as lawmakers have already reportedly been targeted by robocalls and text messages from a mysterious group called Forward America. Now, apparently, there is little public information about this group and its aggressive voter outreach campaign, but a Politico reporter who lives in Indiana said that he has received about 24 calls and messages in recent days on this.
Wow. That's some money somebody's spending there.
So pressure from the party's authoritarian in chief is now coming in hard for Republicans in Indiana, which we will continue to watch, of course, as this race to the gerrymandering bottom continues, thanks to Trump's corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, which essentially threw the doors open to this, mandating that federal law has no power to prevent partisan gerrymanders. So it is now open season. Speaking of our authoritarian in chief, no corner of the federal government is being spared right now from his hostile takeover, including, yes, the Smithsonian Institution, the beloved Smithsonian Institution, which is now facing threat from a Florida insurance attorney turned White House special assistant to the president. Enlisted with the task of bullying the beloved 179-year-old institution founded in 1846, which is, by the way, for those who don't know much about history, like our president, actually a full 15 years before the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. That's when the Smithsonian was founded. So maybe they know a thing or two about American history. Despite the demands from the White House to whitewash the institution's 21 museums, 14 education and research centers, and the National Zoo to better reflect what the Trump White House describes as Americanism. So what is Americanism exactly, and where does that phrase originate from? History professor Seth Kotler of Willamette University joins us next to discuss exactly that and more right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
I am very proud now that we have a museum in the National Mall where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. About the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
What a wonderful world it would be. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Speaking of not knowing much about history, last week the White House special assistant to the president, Lindsey Halligan, sent a letter to the director of the Smithsonian Institution, Secretary Lonnie Bunch, notifying him that the White House was planning an internal review of Smithsonian exhibitions and materials. The review followed on news stories that after its own recent review, as requested by the administration, the Smithsonian found just one instance that required change at the Smithsonian's Museum of American History, a reference to Trump's two impeachments during his first term, which was removed from an exhibit on presidential impeachments, but returned with slightly less context shortly after the removal was noted and reported by the Washington Post. Halligan's letter on behalf of the Trump White House to the head of the Smithsonian, it was made clear that the administration was planning to review the material of at least eight of the Smithsonian's 21 museums, including the National Museum of American History, National Museum of Natural History, National Museum of African American History and Culture, National Museum of the American Indian, National Air and Space Museum, Smithsonian American Art Museum, National Portrait Gallery, and the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. Quote, "We view this process as a collaborative and forward-looking opportunity," wrote Halligan in the White House letter, "one that empowers museum staff to embrace a revitalized curatorial vision rooted in the strength, breadth, and achievements of the American story. By focusing on Americanism," Halligan explained, and stick a pin in that word Americanism for the moment, "the people, principles, and progress that define our nation, we can work together to renew the Smithsonian's role as the world's leading museum institution." In response to that somewhat menacing letter from a, yes, lawyer at the White House, the Organization of American Historians, founded in 1907 and now the largest professional society dedicated to the teaching and study of American history, spoke out in response in no uncertain terms in a public statement that, as you might guess, includes quite a bit of history on the Smithsonian itself along the way. Quote, "The Organization of American Historians expresses deep concern and dismay about the unprecedented White House letter to the esteemed historian, Secretary Lonnie G. Bunch III, directing an internal review of eight Smithsonian museums in alignment with the administration's executive order on, quote, restoring truth and sanity to American history. This correspondence and its underlying command represent an unacceptable instance of ongoing executive overreach, striking at the independence of one of our nation's preeminent historical and cultural institutions. No president," the OAH writes, "has the legitimate authority to impose such a review. Established by Congress in 1846 as a unique and independent agency, the Smithsonian Institution is not and has never been under the authority of the executive branch. It is an independent statutory agency led by the secretary and governed by a bipartisan board of regents as established by law. This legal structure is ignored by the White House letter," they say. "The White House's efforts to assert control over the Smithsonian staff, archives, donors, public-facing content, curatorial process, exhibition planning, and collection use constitutes an alarming infringement on the autonomy and integrity of this 179-year-old distinguished institution. Moreover, it asks the hundreds of professionals who work at the Smithsonian to violate their ethics and their dedication to free and open historical inquiry. The effort," they write, "as outlined, is divorced from the realities of an evidence-based comprehensive telling of the U.S. past and is part of an aggressive push to flatten American history into a narrowly conceived, unrepresentative, and simplified story. Historians, scholars, or subject area experts will not be conducting this mandated review, but rather it will be undertaken by presidential appointees aligned with a specific political agenda. This is exactly what the architects of Smithsonian independence sought to avoid. The group writes, the end result of this process will be the opposite of a fulsome presentation of the history of the United States that reflects the Smithsonian's mission for, quote, the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Instead, they say the review and the method used to compel it will undoubtedly be in service of authoritarian control over the national narrative, collective memory, and national collections. And, well, if you ever thought you might be leaning too far forward by describing the Trump administration as authoritarian, hopefully the perspective of the 118-year-old Organization of American Historians calling out this attempt at, quote, authoritarian control over the national narrative and more, well, that should offer you some backing. Hopefully, it'll offer some backing to outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post, who too often in this moment seem to be pulling their punches from calling what is going on right now for what it actually is. The Organization of American Historians goes on to describe the White House threat as, quote, historical censorship and sanitizing tied to the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding, which should be a moment, they say, for thoughtful reflection about and celebration of the American experiment with all of its tragedies and triumphs. The historians' statement concludes by calling on, quote, all historians, curators, designers, and artists, and all who appreciate and love the search for our past, to resist and condemn in whatever ways they can this White House effort to control the American imagination. As if any more evidence was needed about what this effort really is, Donald Trump on Tuesday took to his failing social media site to note, quote, the Smithsonian is out of control, where everything discussed is how horrible our country is and how bad slavery was. How bad slavery was? Well, I have not been to a Smithsonian museum for too many years now, frankly, but the president might be right there. I do not remember any exhibits at our national museums explaining how good slavery actually was. But it was the comment in Halligan's letter to the Smithsonian's director about the call for, quote, focusing on Americanism that led historian Seth Kotler of Willamette University to take to social media in answering the Organization of American Historians' call to, quote, resist and condemn in whatever way they can this White House effort to control the American imagination. Joining us now is Seth Kotler, professor of history at Willamette University in Portland, Oregon, where he specializes in the history of the United States between the American Revolution and the Civil War. He is an award-winning author of Tom Paine's America, The Rise and Fall of Transatlantic Radicalism in the Early Republic, and he is working on a new book about the long history of the U.S. right. Going to be a very long and getting longer by the day book, I suspect. Professor Kotler also publishes an independent newsletter named Rightlandia. Seth Kotler, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast, Professor. I want to get to your sort of eye-opening thread on Blue Sky about the origins and the true meaning of the phrase Americanism, as cited by Florida insurance lawyer turned White House special assistant to the president and Smithsonian threatener Lindsey Halligan. But I was struck by the response, as you heard, from the Organization of American Historians. I think you're a member of that group, and their statement, correct me if I'm wrong there, but their statement to all of this, I don't know the history of the OAH, but I imagine a dusty old, you know, 118-year-old Society of Historians is generally not prone to knee-jerk alarmism, and for it to use that kind of language that it does, warning of, you know, unacceptable ongoing executive overreach, authoritarian control by the Trump administration, that is not something they take lightly or do every day, I'm guessing. Am I right about that? What should we take from the language of that kind of statement from an organization like the OAH?
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot for the OAH to issue a statement like that. They don't issue statements like that quite often. I haven't looked to see how often they've done it, but it's not a regular thing that they are focused on. Mm-hmm. And I think what they perceived, like a good historian would, is when something that is quite unprecedented and new is happening, mm-hmm. that is a sign that there's something important and significant happening. And so, you know, the idea of a president appointing a Florida insurance lawyer, yes. to micromanage the exhibits at the Smithsonian is something that has never happened, and is quite an unusual step, mm-hmm. Though it's very much in line with much of what the Trump administration is currently doing in other areas, you know, trying to control what law firms do, try to control what news outlets do, et cetera, what universities do. So it's part of a broader project,
which is why I was glad to see them use that sort of language. I wish our media would not pull quite as many punches and would use. I thought, you know, that kind of language was both appropriate here and certainly caught my eye. In your Blue Sky thread, Professor, the one that caught my attention, you begin by noting that, quote, the stated purpose for reviewing Smithsonian exhibits and collections is to ensure they align with something called, quote, Americanism, a term which you note, quote, has a notable genealogy. If you could, Professor Kotler, step me through some of that genealogy as you did in your Blue Sky thread, because I found it both enlightening and important in understanding this moment and what has led to it, not to mention that some of that history runs straight through your state of Oregon, it seems, where we have a lot of listeners, by the way. So proceed carefully, Seth.
a term like Americanism, the beauty of it for those who are using it is that it's so vague that, you know, how could an American be opposed to Americanism, right? But then if you drill down, it's like, well, but what does that mean? Like, what is the content of this Americanism? So if they're going to be using this as the litmus test, what things that would be at the Smithsonian would be operating against Americanism? It's a very undefined thing, which is typical of an authoritarian regime where they say, oh, we're going to align everything with this concept of Americanism, and then they just get to decide what it is, right? And build their power how they want. But Americanism is, you know, rhetorically, it's just a vague, kind of meaningless term. But historically, it was a term that was used by the far right in the U.S. In order to push illiberal, I would argue often fascistic visions of the nation, usually racist, often anti-Semitic, that was, and they contrasted it with what they called communism, what they saw as communism. So to give an example, one great avatar of Americanism in the immediate post-World War II era was a guy named Gerald L.K. Smith, who was the founder of the Christian Nationalist Crusade and also something called the America First Party. Those terms, these were in the 1940s that he founded these. And Gerald L.K. Smith was one of America's leading anti-Semites who believed that communism was a Jewish conspiracy and who believed that Jews could not properly be American because they weren't Christian. And he also believed that the communists were behind the civil rights movement, such as it was in the 1940s and 50s. So for example, he blamed Truman's efforts to integrate the military in the late 1940s. He called that a communist plot that was hatched by Jews to destroy white Christian America. And so by Americanism, what he meant was this kind of nostalgic view of a all-white, all-Christian, kind of small-town America. Him was the real America, as opposed to what he saw as a kind of degenerating, immoral, anti-Christian, kind of, he would call it globalist, a kind of internationalist. He also hated the United Nations, which he saw as an anti-American thing. And so it was this kind of isolationist, racist, anti-Semitic vision of America in which America had nothing to do with multiracial democracy. America had nothing to do with religious pluralism. America was a white Christian nation, and that's what Americanism was.
And, and, And it seems like there was a history of the use of this this phrase, this idea, sort of in this very same context, going all the way back, you know, to World War I, as it was promoted by white elites at the time. It was then embraced by the KKK in the 20s, picked up by the American anti-communist movement in the 50s and 60s. It seems like it has always sort of been there, vague as it was, but if we, you know, judge a word by its company, the company that it's kept has been this sort of the same echo of this white nationalist right-wingers going back for more than 100 years at this point.
Right. Yeah. And I have no idea how Lindsay Halligan, I suspect, has no idea what the term means. I don't think she's aware of this history. Mm-hmm. I doubt it. She doesn't seem to know much about history anyway. But
and yet they put her in charge of overseeing the historic revisions at the Smithsonian.
Yeah. Well, you know, the guy in charge of the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't seem to know much about economics. But, you know, there you go. To me, the phrase, it's kind of irrelevant whether they are aware of these historical resonances. I suspect there are people in the administration who are aware of these historical resonances. Uh-huh. But it's that term has functioned very effectively as a tool of kind of radicalization, we might say, so that, you know, Gerald L. K. Smith would speak in public and he would say, "I'm just an advocate for Americanism." And the audience, you know, comprised of people who maybe didn't agree with him, didn't even know who he was, would be like, "Oh, well, that's fine. That sounds good. Americanism." Right. And then he would explain what he means by it and kind of get more specific. And, you know, maybe some people in the audience would be like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. That's Americanism." But a lot of other people who, you know, he was a great orator. He was a very effective speaker, that it would be a way to like foster a sense of like, this is what it means to be American, right? It means to be white and Christian, and people who are not white and Christian are somehow not quite as truly American as anybody else. And the reason why they're not is because they're part of some international conspiracy of communism that is run by these culturally alien people who also control the media, control the government, control higher education, et cetera, and who are out to get you and are out to destroy you. So this is where Americanism gets connected up to these kind of like apocalyptic conspiracy theories that justify things like banning books or controlling what is taught at a university or what is in a museum, right? Because you're countering some poison
that's
out to destroy the country, and, supposedly.
And we saw something that seems very similar with Trump's embrace of the phrase America First throughout all of his presidential campaigns, which has a similarly ignominious background, as I understand it. Can you speak to both the background of that phrase, the America First movement, and if it's possible that is it possible that Donald Trump understands any of this? I mean, it's one thing his White House attorney assigned to this job, but when he uses phrase like America First and Americanism, does he know what he's doing? Because I suspect, you know, some would claim that he doesn't, and therefore they'd forgive his use of those phrases or argue that we should overlook that previous history of these words because, you know, that, of course, is not what Donald Trump means at all when he uses them.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess I would resist putting too much weight on what he knows or doesn't know or what his intent is. And also, you know, these terms are very... You know, vague. Just because someone says America First doesn't mean that they're a Nazi, right, or a fascist. But the terms themselves carry a certain historical weight. So Pat Buchanan, for example, used America First as his motto in the 1990s.
Right.
And he very much knew, because he was raised by a father who loved Francisco Franco and was an isolationist before World War II. So Pat Buchanan was very aware of what that America First label meant. And the people in Trump's movement who do know this history are very aware of what the term America First means and its genealogy. So, you know, and the genealogy stretches back to the World War I era. It was a term that the KKK in the 1920s used. But most prominently, it's known as the term used by the isolationist movement in the run-up to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that the isolationist movement in the run-up to World War II was a very complicated coalition of people. There were some leftists, there were some socialists involved with it. Gerald Ford was involved with America First for a while. So, you know, you can't just pigeonhole America First as just one thing, but a significant component of people who were in the America First movement were people who felt like what Germany was doing to the Jews was not our business and was probably actually kind of fine. And that it would be okay if Germany were to accomplish its goals. So there was a segment of Americans who were America First, who were isolationists, because they were sympathetic to the Nazis. And then after Pearl Harbor, America First basically vanishes as a public thing, right? Uh-huh. It becomes incredibly hard to be opposed to the war after Pearl Harbor. So anyone using the term America First after Pearl Harbor is pretty much a Nazi. It's like, so it was a much smaller group of people. But those folks who clung on to the moniker of America First after Pearl Harbor were generally American Nazi sympathizers, mm-hmm. like Gerald L. K. Smith.
And then all of a sudden, about 80 years later, it seems to rear its ugly head again from the mouth of Donald Trump, who actually says that, that he's the one who thought of it, America First. But while we don't know if people who use America First in Trump's case or Americanism in Trump's case are actually, secretly neo-Nazis, it does seem at the same time, if, neo-Nazis took over the nation, one of the things they would do is try to rewrite history in the same way that Donald Trump seems to be doing here with this review at the Smithsonian. There's a lot going on. And, a review of Smithsonian exhibits is probably the least of, most Americans' worries right now regarding the damage that Trump is doing to this nation. But my sense from all of this, and I believe it may be reflected in that response from the Organization of American Historians, is that coming for the Smithsonian, of all places, sort of strikes at the very heart of American history and the American story itself. That this is not just nibbling around the edges of American history, right-wing MAGA, pro-slavery, neo-Nazi Twitter trolling, but it is a direct assault on pretty much everything that we currently understand about the American story. They are going for it here, it seems to me. First, is that your impression about this effort as well, Seth Kotler?
Yeah, very much. I mean, one definition of fascism Roger Griffin has offered is that it's it's a form of palingenetic ultra-nationalism. Is what he calls it, kind of right-wing palingenetic ultranationalism. And palingenetic is a big word for this idea that what the nation needs is a rebirth, right? That the nation is degenerated and it needs to be reborn. Mm. And so this whole idea of make America great again, the idea that America was, there was this golden age in the past that we've fallen away from, and the reason why we've fallen away from it is because of them. There was some conspiracy on the part of radical leftists, communists, whoever, right? People who supposedly hate America. Mm-hmm. And we need to displace those people and punish them and replace them with true Americans, with real Americans. Mm-hmm. And so that is itself a historical argument, right? About what's happened to the country. And so it's a vision of the future that's premised upon restoring some nostalgic vision of some idyllic past. Mm-hmm. And so this is where the history piece very much fits into it. I mean, it requires them. So this is why, for example, the Department of Homeland Security's social media accounts are clearly run by someone very familiar with this variety of fascistic expression, right?
Yep.
So all these images from the 30s and 40s, from the era, the height of fascism around the world, with these kind of stylized images of a clean, pristine America in which there are no people of color, in which there's no crime, in which there's no poverty. This was the Depression, after all, but never mind. And so it just presents this completely, distorted visual imagery of this idyllic past to which supposedly Donald Trump's policies are going to return us, right? And so, and it's connected to a vision of masculinity, right? This is when men will have their factory jobs back. Mm-hmm. It's connected to the trad wife thing. This is when women will now learn their proper place and go mm-hmm. back into home and happily cook and clean and sew for the men they so love and the many white children that they're bearing. So all of this culture war stuff that Trumpism is about is absolutely a historical argument, right, about what America was once like, what it's now like, and what it should be like. And so I think their goal is to expunge from the Smithsonian any parts of American history that might intrude upon that kind of nostalgic vision. What America once was.
And it seems, like I said, but, you know, sort of going back and forth, because we only have so much time to cover all of these nightmares and, you know, trying to pick and choose what matters and what doesn't. But I think David Kurtz over at TPM today puts this into some perspective, or at least he did for me. He said, I usually cast President Trump's anti-immigrant mass deportation agenda as a rule of law story, but it is much more than that. It is fundamentally a story about racism, xenophobia, and othering. It's about preying on our fears, differences, and prejudices to create a villainous foe who he can easily vanquish. It's about letting loose the worst of our impulses to heighten and sustain divisions among us. The mass deportation agenda is just one part of a larger agenda in which white Americans are fronted as the real Americans and everyone else is second class. It's against this backdrop that much of this week's news, he says, is taking place. Trump minimizing of chattel slavery, the federalization of D.C. police, and the deployment of red state National Guards to a plurality black city in D.C., the phasing out of support from non-native English speakers in school, new hoops for legal immigrants to jump through, and a gauntlet of other indignities and slights that preference white citizens. This move by the White House against the Smithsonian, as much as it seems the last of our worries, sort of seems to me to be a piece with all of it, which makes it, I think, as important because it is all a part of the same thing. Am I seeing it properly? Do you see it that way as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, at the RNC, Hulk Hogan, remember when he introduced Donald Trump, he used the phrase real Americans in almost every sentence. He even had a brand of beer called Real American Beer that he was hawking. But it was this idea that the people who vote for Donald Trump are the real Americans, which then raises the question of, are you less real if you don't vote for Donald Trump? Are you less really an American? And I think their answer is like, yes, you are. You're less real American. And so what this does is it creates this, this impression that this isn't just a dispute about policy. It's not a dispute about how big or small the government should be, et cetera, and so forth. It's about, are you an American or are you not? And this is where the Americanism piece, and this is the kind of sharp edge of nationalism historically, right? Nationalism can serve as a unifying force that brings people together across differences, or nationalism can be a force that a government uses to identify who is inside the nation and who is outside of it, and then using its force and power to make that real. And so, you know, the talk of denaturalization now that's coming out of this administration, mm-hmm. is much of a piece with this. And the idea that they're targeting, you know, foreign students who just had a social media post they don't like, and they don't get to be in America now. And so it's this heightened fear of threats to the nation that they identify with various thought crimes or statement crimes, or just being brown in LA, that is of a piece with this kind of illiberal, exclusionary vision of what a real American is. So when you take that back into the history, just so to use another example, during the American Revolution, right? So Prager University has created a bunch of AI videos about the founding era. And from what I can tell, about 98% of the people who are featured in those videos are white men. And at the time of the revolution, 20% of everyone who lived in the 13 colonies was enslaved, was an enslaved person of African descent. 20%. So if you were to just travel through the through the 13 colonies, one out of every five people you would see would be a black person who was enslaved. And that's an important part of the history of the American Revolution. But that's, you know, oh, but slavery's bad. We shouldn't really talk about that. And so we end up telling a history of the American Revolution in which slavery is just a kind of minor sidelight to the whole thing, and is not kind of an integral part of the story, especially in the South, in terms of how mobilization worked in states where slavery was more prominent. So, you know, this desire to just obliterate those parts of our history and to also erase the existence and presence of people who aren't white and Christian in American history, and to erase the history of women in the U.S., the history, the LGBTQ history in the U.S., which they've done with Stonewall, stories about that, right? So all of it involves this kind of weirdly like Stalin-esque, Orwellian kind of effort to just, you know, obliterate parts of the actual historical record. Like, it's not a question of interpretation as to whether there were like trans women involved at Stonewall. Like, that's just a fact. It's just a historical record. It's not a matter of debate. How we interpret that, what we make of it is something we can talk about. But like, to just erase the presence of those folks from what happened at Stonewall is a truly kind of authoritarian, kind of terrifying act done through fiat from the executive branch of the United States and in all of our name.
And, you know, I have, I am not one who is inclined to, shout Nazi at every Republican administration that comes along. And even in both the first Trump administration and for the first few months of the second term of Donald Trump, I have. I am naturally inclined to shy away from that word unless it's, you know, really appropriate. You referenced nationalism, which of course was known in Germany as Nazism. You referenced the story that we've been, covering the Department of Homeland Security's social media account, which is using literal Nazi images and fonts and so forth. And then we get to the Organization of American Historians warning about the authoritarian control of this White House. And at the same time, I'm complaining that the corporate media is not sufficiently calling this out for what it is. Should we be calling this out for what it is? Does it appear? I mean, because all of the evidence suggests that, even if this isn't Hitler and the Nazis who killed millions and millions of people, they sort of, as they were compiling their power, gathering their power, were doing many of the very same things that we are seeing now from this administration. As someone who's working on a book about the American right, am I right about that? Is it? Am I leaning too forward on my skis to, in warning people that, hey, this is exactly what we did see in the lead up to the Holocaust eventually?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is where, you know, historical analogies and comparisons are sometimes useful and sometimes not. You can't step in the same river twice, right? Nazism is a specific reference to the political culture of 1930s and 40s Germany. There are certainly ways we can compare the rhetoric, the imagery, and so on. But fascism would be the more generalized term, right, that people would use. So there's Italian fascism. I mean, basically every modern country has its own thread of a fascistic political culture. And the U.S. is no different, right? The U.S. has had a fascistic thread in our political culture since the KKK, arguably, in the 1920s.
But they didn't have this kind of control of the nation until
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so historian Robert Paxton, who writes about the history of fascism, one of his key insights is that fascism is a historical dynamic that moves through stages. And sometimes there are places where a fascistic political culture develops and emerges in a country, but then it fails to achieve political power. And then it kind of fades in its influence and power. So it's not just a one-directional thing. It's not like once you reach this stage, well, then it's all over. Mm. And it inevitably moves in one direction or another. There is no inevitability, right, in history. So this, that's why the Nazi analogy, you know, can sometimes break down, because you see things that look similar and you're like, oh, well, we know what happened next. Mm. And indeed, we do know what happened next in the 1930s and 40s. But that, just because that happened in the 30s and 40s, doesn't mean it's going to happen again. Right?
Also, it means that we have agency here. We can stop it from happening again, because we know what happened in the 30s and 40s. And but, you know, frankly, we know that because of historians like you. And I could talk with you all day, Seth. I hope to do that again in the future. Sure. But I'm going to point folks for now, of course, to your social media site. On Blue Sky, Seth Kotler, C-O-T-L-A-R, where you can follow him there. You can sign up for his newsletter, rightlandia.ghost.io is the address for that. Seth Kotler is a professor of history at Willamette University in Portland, specializing in the history of the U.S. Between the American Revolution and the Civil War. He's also the author of Tom Paine's America, The Rise and Fall of Transatlantic Radicalism in the Early Republic, and working on a new book right now on the long history of the U.S. right. Do you have, by the way, do you have a title or a publishing date for that that we should look for, Seth?
No, it's a long way off. But right now, I think Rightlandia is my, you know, because it's about, basically the story is about a neo-Nazi who becomes the chair of the Oregon Republican Party in 1978, which is kind of a shocker of a headline.
It would have been. Now it's just ho-hum, you know, every day. Are you kidding? Anyway, I'll point folks towards that website when we post today's show at bradblog.com. Seth Kotler, really appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
You bet. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Yeah, I think these things are all of a piece.
Yes, I really appreciated how he connected the dots on how white nationalists, their vision of an idyllic past requires rewriting history so that they can then determine and get to define who is a real American and who is not a real American. Very dangerous stuff.
Dangerous indeed, but we will stand up to that danger, frankly. By the way, before we get out here, speaking of standing up to this jerk, on Wednesday, a third judge has now refused Trump's attempt to distract Americans from his refusal to order the release of the DOJ's files on his former best friend, the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Trump is in those files, so apparently does not want them released. Apparently he's in the files, but I guess not mentioned in the grand jury testimony that he does want released. Grand jury testimony before the leading to the indictments of Epstein and his partner Ghislaine Maxwell, who joined him in sex trafficking minors. They were all pals for about 10 years or more. It is that grand jury testimony, then, that Trump wants to release because they don't mention him, I guess, and because he thinks it'll satisfy those, including his own supporters, who are demanding that he keep his campaign promise to release the Epstein files. On Wednesday, then, a third judge has said no, those transcripts may not be released under federal law. That, of course, is just one of many things that Trump has been doing of late to try to help distract from the issue, which, no matter what he does, according to a group describing themselves as a gathering of old-time musicians, just ain't gonna go away.
Presidential day. It ain't gonna go away. It ain't gonna go. this time. There's lots of pages you'd like to redact while you're slipping with the slide. Play golf. You can go to war today. You can point your finger at everyone else, but it ain't gonna go away. Yeah. The victims all deserve that till we root out each bad seed.
No, it ain't going to go away. The gathering of old-time musicians. Good luck, by the way, getting that earworm out of your head. It ain't going away either. Anyway, we got to get out. My thanks to our guest today, Seth Kotler of Willamette University, and to my producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated and an honor. Thank you. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other that we've ever done since the beginning of time, or the beginning of history, as we should say here today, you can always download them for free at bradblog.com, which is thanks to those of you who choose to hit the donate button while you're there. Make a donation of any amount you can afford, one-time donation, or even better, a monthly subscription of any amount you can afford. We count on you to stay on your public airwaves. So thank you in advance. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time with Digby and Driftglass, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world!
It ain't gonna go away.